All right, all right, all right. I should turn that down. All right, it's the show. Sitting here live on the radio in a Twitter argument. Yeah, well. Hey, so I'm Scott. This is the show. Scott Horton Show. Joe Lauria is going to be here. I says to Joe, I says, hey, Joe, can you do the show? And he says, yeah, but I got to go to Iranian President Rouhani's press conference first. Maybe we can talk after that. Sounds good to me. Question number one. So what did the Iranian president say at his press conference? Stuff writes itself. All right. And John Neffel's going to be here to talk about the FBI and this new ACLU report on the FBI out of control. By the way, there's a new one out in McClatchy today about how they've been flying drones in the U.S. since 2006. The feds have. Good times. All right, so we'll be talking about that with John Neffel. I forgot. I've interviewed him. You know what it was? It was about... well, I know it was about police abuse. I think it was like a top 10 list of horrible police brutality or shooting incidents, killings of innocents just from the last, you know, 6 weeks or something like that. Recent outrages, recent government atrocities. Something like that. He'd written it for Alternet, I believe. Well, here he is at the Rolling Stone on the FBI's domestic spying. So that'll be good. Should be. And, yeah, of course, there's lots of news to talk about. The most important bit of news, well, I don't know. I guess the most important immediate thing is that the U.S. and Russia have reached a deal on serious chemical weapons at the United Nations, and it does not have the use of force as the or else in there. Barack Obama, I thought, sounded just like George W. Bush, saying, if you don't give me the authorization to use force against Iraq, then that just proves that the UN is a tired and weak and feckless, pathetic entity that can't even enforce its own resolutions. Come on, UN. Have some backbone. Stand up for yourself. All that kind of crap. Well, it didn't work. I mean, how's that supposed to work anyway? Like, the General Assembly is going to pressure Russia into, you know, voting for an authorization to use force because that's what America says. Really? Why would they even try that? It just makes them sound weaker to stake out a tougher position and then still blow it. But, anyway, so there they go. They settled. Now, of course, with George W. Bush, he had to settle. He got Resolution 1441 that said there will be consequences, but they swore to the French and the Russians and the Chinese. That doesn't mean that we'll do anything. There will have to be a second resolution to authorize force. And then they knew they couldn't get their second resolution because there was no evidence whatsoever of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and plenty of evidence of absence. And so they wouldn't vote the second resolution, and so George Bush invaded Iraq anyway, because what are you going to do about it? It's like a cop running the red light. Oh yeah, there's the law and everything, it's just that the people in charge of enforcing it are immune from it. Big surprise. That's what they say. War is just an extension of domestic politics by other means and all that, right? It's all just fighting over resources. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know that. This guy in my Twitter says that Thomas Mountain works for the government and lacks objectivity. I think maybe I should have both of those guys on the show to fight about it. I think I'm going to tweet this guy back right now. Well, I should have both of y'all on the show to fight about it. I like Thomas Mountain. I think he does a pretty good job. I have seen him criticized in my comment section anyway about how he loves the government of Eritrea too much. I am suspicious of anybody who approves of any state government anywhere in the world, you know? What's a government except a collection of gangsters and thieves and murderers writ large? But anyway, and actually I wish he would stop talking sometimes and let me follow up a little bit, because he does filibuster on a bit. But you know, I like his articles. And he's given me really good interviews on Somalia, on Ethiopia, on Mali and Libya. I can't think of much I've ever had to disagree with about Mr. Mountain there. Seems like he does good work to me. Anyway, so there's somebody in my Twitter right now who is critical of Thomas Mountain's. We're having a discussion about it. By the way, did I mention, you can follow me on Twitter at @ScottHortonShow. Same thing for Facebook, too. Facebook.com/ScottHortonShow. And also YouTube if you want to watch videos of me giving speeches. And, you know, you could hire me to give a speech. I'll give a speech for you guys, too. All that's at YouTube.com/ScottHortonShow. And hey, I also forgot to mention to you, join up the chat room. So join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. I'm in there now. So's Roscoe P. Coltrane. Now see, when I was a kid, I never got it that P was his middle initial. I thought his last name was P. Coltrane, which I thought was a very strange last name. I wasn't familiar with the last name Coltrane, you know, notwithstanding the Dukes and everything. So, just be Coltrane, I thought. Now you know a little bit more about me than you ever wanted to know. Anyway, back to Obama backing down, just like always. Thank God he backed down in this case. Didn't I tell you that I thought there was a pretty good chance he's going to back down? Because thank goodness he's such a tiny little pathetic coward. If he was a real man, we'd be up to our eyeballs in another war right now. Thank goodness he's not. Thank goodness he's a ridiculous little sissy who backs down from every threat he's ever made, from every promise he's ever made, other than to escalate the war in Afghanistan, which he followed through on. Every other thing he ever said he would do, he backed down from, good or bad. So I'll take it. You know what? Good. That's right. Back down. Sign that resolution that Putin wrote for you, you little punk. Anyway, so there's no threat of force in there. But I think that the Russians are going to make sure that the Syrians really do give up all the chemical weapons. One, because it's going to look bad if they don't. Hey, Russia, come on. You said that you were going to. And not that the non-aligned movement is on America's side in this one or anything like that, but just, it'll look bad if they don't live up to what they say they're going to live up to. This is, I won't say Putin's big chance, but it's a situation where he can seem to be a statesman instead of just a politician kind of a thing, right? To his audience, anyway. And also, if chemical weapons used by the regime against the so-called rebels, mostly foreign mercenaries, suicide bombers in league with Ayman al-Zawahiri, if chemical weapons used by the regime against them is the red line, then taken away the magic marker so that the red line can't even possibly be drawn anymore is just another way of saying that America gives Assad permission to stay in power. And they're taking back, again, Barack Obama backing down, thank God, from his previously stated position that he had no right to lay down in the first place, that Assad must go, as he and Hillary said it last year. As Jay Carney, the White House spokesman, put it just, 2 days or something before the so-called gas attack back in August. The policy is still that Assad must go. Not that we'll really do anything to make sure that that happens. More like we're just going to set these guys up for a gigantic slow motion Bay of Pigs disaster. And you know what? It's not non-interventionism, but it's better than regime change. And now maybe I'm reading that wrong, but I don't think so. Wasn't this what we already had kind of figured, that Obama was too afraid to do a regime change? He already was backing down and leaving Assad in power. He just couldn't stop saying that. He don't want a regime change. He's terrified of regime change in Syria, as he rightly should be. As we said on this show for years and years, regime change Syria, there's no one else to take power except maybe the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's if you're lucky. It could be a lot worse than that. So it looks to me like the deal that Obama has made with Putin is, look, get all the chemicals out there, and then I won't have any excuse to bomb them ever again, right? So go ahead and get rid of them. I think the Russians probably are going to, I hope, are going to take advantage of that situation and see it through. Get the chemical weapons out of there. And then, you know, I don't know. There are decent people who want to kill Assad and be free of his tyranny, man, but they're just not the fighters in this war, that's all. This did start out as a protest movement, as Brendan O'Neill was saying on the show the other day. It was in the summer of 2011. In fact, you could say, after launching the war in Libya and everything, it took until the summer of 2011 before the Americans, the Brits, the French could get off of their duffs and get their act together and begin to screw over the protesting masses of Syria. And Assad was making concessions, too. I don't know how meaningful they really were right off the bat there, but there was a table, and they were sitting at it, so to speak. And then the Americans came and said, nope, must go. No legitimacy. It's up to us to decide whether you stay or go, and we decide that you must go. So there you go. It's tough for them. And, you know, the thing of it is, and I had this confused, and I don't think I could probably blame anybody else. I think it's just my own damn fault transposing numbers in my brain because, you know, it's organic material. It's only so efficient. Apparently, what I've been reading lately, it's really 70% of the population of Syria are Sunni Arabs, oppressed under this minority dictatorship. So, you know, it's almost like Iraq numbers, only just switched around. A minority Shiite Ba'athist dictatorship instead of a minority Sunni Ba'athist dictatorship. It's, but the same kind of thing. You know, it's not like I'm rooting for Assad. I can't stand that the American government, come on, I'm even laughing about it because I just don't know what else to do here. I've been crying about it for 2.5 years or something and nobody cares. America's backing Al-Qaeda. You know, somebody sent me a tweet yesterday. Might have been Angela Keaton. Sent me a link to to Pamela Geller, the madman, the bigot. And she's got pictures of these jihadists in a USAID tent. And the tent has USAID printed all over it like some promotional material. And these jihadist guys, I don't know if they're from the Northern Storm or the Farouk Brigade or Al-Nusra Front or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham or whatever the hell, different brigade of jihadists. But, man, and then Pamela Geller writes, the irony here is that me and her are like this on this one. And she says, man, you know, her whole thing, of course, is Obama's a secret Kenyan Muslim terrorist, blah, blah, blah kind of thing is why he's doing it, which is ridiculous. He's doing it because he's a white, half-white, conservative, nationalist, imperialist. And he figures it's in America's interest to do it. He's not fighting for them. He's using them, but he is fighting for them. But he thinks that he's the one zooming them rather than being Zoom. That's all. But anyway, she says, look, man, doesn't anybody remember people jumping out of the Twin Towers, breaking those windows, and having the choice like, wow, okay, here's the end of my life. I'm either going to burn to death right now or I'm going to jump out of a skyscraper. Doesn't anybody remember that? The attack on New York and D.C.? And we're letting our government back these men who have sworn their allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, who at best are second cousins of the 9/11 hijackers. And I'm going Pam Geller for mayor, man. That's some of the best sense I've heard talked on the Syria issue in a while now. And now, why is that? What in the hell? Everybody's, I don't know, everybody who, you know what it is? It's that the super majority of people who are concerned at all about foreign policy have a stake in it. You know, they're on their own life quest to gain power and influence so that they can get foreign policies that they want to satisfy their interests. And so saying things like John McCain and Barack Obama both are guilty of high treason and should be hanged is not really on their list of talking points for their career path. And then there's the rest of us who just, what, have it as a hobby that we care who our government kills. No one else is paying attention at all. It's you, me, and Pam Geller. Someone ought to let her know Netanyahu's on Obama and McCain's side on this one. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Oh, man, I did it again, didn't I? I forgot to
Change the music over to Friday's music. Boy, this is going to be too late now, too. Oh, well. All right. Well, thanks, Ozzy, for the harmonica there, man. And Tony and Geezer and the rest of you guys for the bass and the drums. All right, yeah. Hey, I'm Scott. This is the show. And coming up here in just a few minutes, John Neffel's going to be on to talk about the FBI, the great criminal organization in the sky. I admit, more than before, for some reason, I'm afraid of talking bad about the FBI. And, of course, that's all I have to say about them is that the Oklahoma bombing happened on their watch, their informants inside the plot. And it happened, and they should all go to prison for that. Also, they burned all the Branch Davidians to death with the help of the Army. And I still got a grudge against them for that. And then all of the bogus terrorism cases. Oh, boo-hoo, orange alert. I'm so scared of the stupidest kid that you could find out of the entire Muslim neighborhood in whatever city where your office is that you tricked into saying he loves Osama into a tape recorder. Oh, he said he loved Osama. I'm going to cry and pee in my pants. I'm so impressed by you guys' warmongering scare propaganda. Wow, I guess we better keep funding you so that you can keep protecting us from retarded kids that you trick into saying they love Osama into a tape recorder. But more and more, I'm terrified of saying that. Like, God, man, I don't know. It's like that book, Three Felonies a Day. I think I'm living life right, you know? I don't know. I'm not, what am I doing wrong? But maybe they could lock me in solitary anyway. And then would even the other Scott Horton and Michael Ratner and the rest of them be able to spring me ever again, you know? Maybe I should just criticize everybody in government except the FBI. The FBI, they're great. They never entrapped anybody. They don't lie. They're not a gigantic, laughable pile of fraud. Oh, who let all the white-collar criminals get away with fraud all day to the tunes of bazillions of dollars, literally uncountable trillions of dollars ripped off from the decent. But, well, you know, maybe it's Friday and I'm just being emotional. Looking forward to the weekend here and everything, but yeah, I'm scared of them. I'm absolutely terrified. But anyway, well, whatever. I have to talk about how bad they are. That way you'll hate them as much as I do. You know what? Here's something funny. Remember Frederick Whitehurst? Frederick Whitehurst came out and said, look, the crime lab is just riddled with errors and corruption and conflict of interest and bogus science. And what happened? They clamped down on him. And that ought to tell you, and that was, you know, 20 years ago now or whatever, 15. That ought to tell you everything you need to know about the FBI, who they are and what they're about. They care only about themselves. They don't care about you. They don't care about the truth. If they cared about you, they would have stopped the 9/11 attack. There were real ass Al-Qaeda in the country for a year and a half, and the FBI wouldn't stop it. Why not? Because they don't care about that. They only care about their own public relations. Louis Free. So, when Frederick Whitehurst came out and said, hey, they're manufacturing evidence in the case of Waco, in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing, in the case of, what was the other major high-profile case that he pointed his finger at him? Maybe it was the Olympic Park bombing, the one that they had blamed on Richard Jewell, remember that? Good police work there, guys. Blame the hero. Anyway, oh, and then the guy who did that, they couldn't even catch him for 6 years or something. But anyway, when Frederick Whitehurst said, hey, we got real problems with the science lab here, they didn't say, well, listen, we are the gold standard of science labs in the world, and so we better, you know, criminal science labs, so we better do what it takes to fix it. No, they clamped down on the whistleblower, on the hero, who was telling the truth, trying to get the wrongs righted. Because that's what they're about. Wrongs. They prefer wrongs. And yeah, you heard me right. Manufacturing evidence in the case of the Oklahoma bombing. In this case, They had no evidence, not a molecule of evidence. And this is not some truth or crap. This is for real, okay? This is an actual thing, not some made-up figment of some nonsense. The FBI, and they admitted, they were forced to admit under cross-examination in the Terry Nichols state trial, that they didn't have a molecule of evidence that an ammonium nitrate bomb was even used. They had a receipt at Nichols' house with McVeigh's thumbprint on it, conveniently found that, yeah, because of course they would have saved that, that said info on it. Okay, if you say so, guys, but then when they claimed that they had found ammonium nitrate in a piece of plywood that had been a piece of the truck that had been bombed, that had been exploded, they were forced to admit under cross-examination after Frederick Whitehurst testified that Super Dave Williams just lied at the FBI crime lab. He just pretended that he had found ammonium nitrate crystals because, you know, they needed to say that there was ammonium nitrate crystals, and so he made it up. That was it. They had no evidence that it was even an ammo bomb that went off that day. I mean, not from the crime scene anyway. They have Terry Nichols' testimony about building the bomb and other things, but anyway, they have no scientific evidence from the crime scene of AMFO. They just lied for some reason. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. I went off on a tangent about how much I hate the FBI. You know what? Here's my favorite picture of the FBI. All you got to do is watch the documentary film Waco, A New Revelation. And there's the FBI after the rubble has finally cooled down enough that they can traipse through it all. And there they are splashing bleach all over the crime scene of their massacre at Waco, where they deliberately set the fire. I don't know if it was the Army, the FBI hostage rescue team that set off the bomb on the ceiling of the concrete room, the cinder block room with the concrete ceiling, where the women and children only were hiding and killed. But they deliberately bombed them and machine gunned them to death. And then there they are, splashing bleach all over the crime scene. That's the Federal Bureau of Investigation for you. They burn children to death and then they pour bleach all over them, you know, before their vaunted crime lab can come in and solve the case for you. Suicide, I heard. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. First guest today is John Neffel, with a silent K, that is. He's an independent journalist. Writes for, well, you can find him at Rolling Stone and Alternet and other places like that. This one's at rollingstone.com. Is the FBI's domestic spying out of control? A new ACLU report shows how the Bureau's domestic surveillance program has exploded since 9/11. So welcome back to the show, John. How are you doing?
Good. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. So is the FBI's domestic spying out of control? And out of control of who?
Well, that's really the question that's going to be at the forefront for civil libertarians for the foreseeable future. And what the ACLU report details very clearly is that following 9/11, the FBI created an Office of Intelligence, and since then, they have really institutionalized this intelligence gathering process in the FBI, and they've turned away from a sort of their what they traditionally had as a sort of strictly law enforcement mandate. And although certainly over the FBI's history they engaged in a lot of intelligence gathering, it's now formalized in a way that we haven't seen before.
Okay, so that's interesting to me, the Office of Intelligence. Is that the same as a division? Like they have the Criminal Division and the Counterintelligence Division. Is this a new separate division, or it's under one of those two, or how does that work exactly? And it's different from the Counterterrorism Division, I guess, too.
Yeah, I believe that it was started as part of the Counterterrorism Division. I'm actually not entirely positive about that, but it's something that that has engaged in all kinds of very, very shady behavior using informants, mapping Muslim communities, things like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, and so let's talk about that first and foremost here, the mapping. What do you mean by that, and what's so bad about that?
Right, so there's this program called Domain Management, and it was partially introduced, implemented by this guy, Philip Mudd, who is a former CIA agent who then went to the FBI to help the FBI with its intelligence gathering. And what domain management does is it allows the FBI to map regions of the country by race, by religion, by ethnicity. And one of the things that I, one of the specifics that I detail in the story that I did is that the field office in Detroit requested permission to do domain management to map the Middle Eastern population and the Muslim population in Michigan, because they say in this memo that was released as part of a FOIA lawsuit that a lot of State Department designated terrorist groups come from the Middle East. There are a lot of people of Middle Eastern descent in Michigan, and so they need authority to map who lives where in Detroit and in Michigan, because they are Muslim, and because they say because so many of these state designated groups come from the Middle East. And so it's a pretty clear, I think, example of profiling. That's not what the FBI says publicly. They say that it's about that the program of domain management is only for specific cases, not for general intelligence gathering. But what one of the people that I talked to for the story, Trevor Aronson, who's done a lot of looking into the FBI for a book that he wrote called The Terror Factory, he said that FBI agents have told him that that they call domain management battlefield management. So that gives you a sort of sense of how at least some agents are approaching this topic.
Yeah, like they're Stanley McChrystal fighting the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq or something, right? This is your kill box. And that one's
right,
mine.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, and it's...
Well, now, so hang on a second here, John. Let me ask you something from a devil's advocate kind of thing, because for me, mm-hmm. of course, I want the FBI abolished, you know, 10 years ago. So I don't think they should do anything at all, but so maybe that's not necessarily the best place to question you from. How about, hey, come on, they got to protect us from the bad guys somehow, and they are a bunch of dunderheads, and so it's not like they can just magically know who the bad guys are. They do need webs of informants throughout the Muslim community to... Someone's got to be around to tell them that, hey, the preacher at that mosque is getting pretty crazy, and some of the young men listening to him seem even crazier than him, and maybe you guys need to go and check out what they're up to, and right or not?
Well, so what the FBI can do is investigate acts of criminality, and arguably, that's the only thing that they should be doing. The author of this report in McDermott is a former FBI agent, uses the example of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and so there are these, of course, the accused Boston bomber, one of the two. In the case of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, you have these stories of him, giving these outbursts in the mosque and challenging the imam and saying that America is the devil and various things like that. And then on the other hand, you have, you also have Tamerlan, traveling abroad, possibly, traveling to get training to meet up with violent groups, and as Mike German lays out, only one of those two is potential criminal behavior, and it's traveling, it's attempting to get training. That's something that the FBI can and probably should be investigating. But the problem is that once you start investigating people based on and investigating groups based on protected First Amendment activity, then that's when you get into very, very serious problems. And that's, in many cases, that's when the sort of the next step of bringing the informants in and establishing these sort of very elaborate stings comes to the forefront. There's this case of the Newburg Four in upstate New York who say that they were entrapped, and their case was actually recently, there was an appeal heard. They were convicted of attempting to bomb synagogues. And on appeal, two of the judges said that the appeal, that the conviction should stand, and that it wasn't a case of entrapment. Now, when you look at the facts of the matter, you have somebody who really, under no reasonable circumstances, could have carried out a terrorist operation on his own. You have this guy, James Cromedy, who at one point is offered $250,000 by the FBI informant to go through with this plan. And so what you have is when the FBI starts singling out groups and looking at groups and potentially investigating them for saying something inflammatory about the United States, what that sometimes leads to is creating these elaborate stings that the FBI can then have these press conferences to say, look, we just foiled a homegrown terror cell, and that justifies massive spending on counterterrorism measures.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is one where I guess I'm not really sure if there's any indicators that we can look to measure whether the people are catching on to this yet, but it's certainly, for anyone who's paying attention to it, it's the most obvious thing in the world that you can count the actual terrorist threats in America since 9/11 on one hand. Moussaoui, who they'd only done their job, they could have stopped the thing in the first place. But then there's Zazi from Denver, and there's what's his name? The Times Square bomber, Faisal Shahzad, and I think I'm missing one other. And the rest of them are all entrapment jobs. Or
yeah,
at least, trumped up charges based on a bunch of hooey, you know?
Yeah, there's the FBI really loves to trot out that there have been 500 or more, they say more than 500 terrorism cases that have been successfully prosecuted since 9/11. And some of those are of sort of low-level money transfers, things that are not actually violent threats. And then many of them are these trumped-up sting operations. And like you said, there are really only, you can probably count on one hand the number of actual threats. And one of the really key points to remember here is that these threats are not as awful as some of them could have been. We're not talking about existential threats to the United States. And I think that a lot of people need to really examine the country's priorities in terms of what kind of violence is absolutely unacceptable, namely any violence that we call terrorism, and what kind of violence is acceptable, which is all kinds of violence, all kinds of death that comes from the stress of poverty, violence that comes from childhood obesity,
from cops, bullets,
gun deaths. There's all kinds of violence in this country that people are fine with, but we as a culture have decided that the only appropriate number of violence from terrorism is zero, and so the NYPD, the FBI, and other agencies have taken on this, I think, really problematic prevent sort of philosophy, and what ends up happening is that you create these huge dragnets, and you end up really terrorizing a lot of local populations.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, of course, also it means missing real attacks and real threats like the Tsarnaev brothers. As we're saying on this show, for which I guess it's pretty easy to just predict for the, you know, indefinite future or whatever, but the next time somebody tries to really blow something up in this country, we can thank, they'll get away with it, and we can thank the FBI for screwing around, chasing their tail, making up these fake attacks so that they can, you know, pat themselves on the back and do a little press conference and whatever and get their funding and all. But meanwhile, innocent people will be dead. And that's what happened in Boston.
Right. And the irony beyond that is that the people who come out, the activists who come out and say, this is unconstitutional, they themselves will likely be made targets of political surveillance, either by the FBI or by local law enforcement forces. Of course, there was a FOIA lawsuit by the Partnership for Justice Fund that revealed that even prior to Occupy Wall Street setting up camp in Zuccotti, members or activists were being surveilled by the FBI, and so you see that level of sort of granular thing at activists, and you also see an enormous amount of cooperation, sometimes some friction, but a lot of cooperation between federal and state officials in these fusion centers that exists throughout the country as a sort of a joint task force where information is centralized and could potentially be used either to find new informants, to flip informants, things like that.
All right. Now, oh, there's a line in here. This is a minor point, John. There's a line in here where I can't even imagine he wrote it. I'm blaming the editor. It says, you know, the NYPD would go so far as to entrap somebody, which to the FBI is completely beyond the pale. But, huh?
Oh, that's the case of Ahmed Farhani. That line is about the similarities between the FBI and NYPD programs, but there are some cases in New York where this guy Ahmed Farhani, where even for the FBI, that case was seemed too much like entrapment for them. So that was a case of the NYPD going so far beyond the pale that even the FBI, who has shown its willingness to engage in all kinds of very questionable stings, even they weren't willing to get on board with the prosecution and the investigation of Ahmed Farhani.
Oh, yeah, I actually remember that one. You know what? I just misread it like it was talking about what the FBI would ever do. But I do remember that in this case, the NYPD was going so far that the FBI said, man, you guys take it from here. We don't want anything to do with this.
Yeah, exactly. And Farhani was, people might remember him. He was called the would-be synagogue bomber. He's a man that the NYPD spent a lot of time investigating, setting up a sting on. He has a history of mental illness, which was very, very well known to the NYPD. He had been in custody for mental health related incidences throughout his teenage years, and his case really is, I think, quite emblematic of how far the NYPD is willing to go to set up these some of these cases. If people want to read more about it, I wrote about it, and the headline for that story is, did the NYPD entrap Ahmed Farhani?
All right, now, so here's the thing about all this, John. I mean, what we're talking about here, mostly 15,000 informants and these insane national security letters that certainly are not Fourth Amendment warrants. Anyway, all this, it only applies to Muslims, and they're the other anyway, right? I mean, they're just a bunch of gooks. They might live here, sort of, but that doesn't really mean that it's our rights being violated. It's just their rights being violated, and so who cares?
Yeah, well, I mean, you do hear that from people, and it's amazing. Because, for one thing, it shows, I think, a sort of really just awful lack of caring about another human being, first and foremost. But it also displays a real ignorance of U.S. history. There have always been demonized groups in the United States, whether it's religious or ethnic minorities, whether it's people who had communist leanings, whether it's LGBT activists. And so one of the things that that the ACLU often says is the rights you are protecting might be your own or are your own. And what's really incredible about people who say that, well, this doesn't apply to me and so I'm not going to care about it, you even hear that from some sort of liberal-leaning people who apparently don't think that there will ever be a Republican president again, or say an anti-choice president. It's very easy to imagine these kinds of apparatuses being used on all sorts of people, on reproductive rights activists, on LGBT activists, on activists who advocate for universal housing, for raising the minimum wage. There's all kinds of undesirables out there, and at some point, you never know when you or somebody that you care about could find yourself on the target end of that.
And well, the thing
that
is, too,
really
gun owners, too, right?
Remember
the fusion centers and the FBI, they've said look out for anybody who calls himself a patriot, who talks about the Constitution, who has a Ron Paul bumper sticker, who owns a gun, who's anti-abortion either, right? Because what we're really talking about, John, is not really left-wing or right-wing issues. What we're talking about is people who have politics that are different than the agenda of the state at any given time. So right-wingers have more reason to be concerned when the Democrats are in power and vice versa. But still, the point being, we've seen in just the recent history, of course, it's not even hypothetical at all. We've seen the national security letters and all these abusive powers invoked against hippies at the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Everything. In fact, they coordinated through Homeland Security and the fusion centers the nationwide simultaneous raiding of the Occupy movement. We've seen anti-war activists infiltrated from all over the place, and we've also seen the Huttery militia and all of this, Rachel Maddow-esque, trumped up wannabe Oklahoma militia terror stuff or whatever, scaremongering against right-wing groups too. And the point is that when there's no law that binds the power of what they can do, but there's only laws that can be applied by them to the rest of us, then it will work out that way. We'll all find out real quick how much we have in common with the Muslims that lived two neighborhoods away and now live in the cell next to us.
Well, right, and a lot of these policies too are they're a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, where in New York, the cops put. If you were a Muslim and you Americanized your name, that meant you got put on the list. If you were a Muslim and you took a more traditional name, that got you on the list. If you displayed newfound religiosity, that got you on the list. If you scaled back your religiosity, if you shaved your beard, if you started dressing more Western, that got you on the list. And so like what you were saying before, there's all, these policies can be amended generally on the fly in terms of what is a sort of warning sign to the state. Those can be changed. They're often open to discretion. And once an incredibly powerful security force has discretion, it will be abused, as we've seen from the NSA revelations.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, whenever it comes out about, an FBI file or another on a peace activist or another, it's always amazing the amount of detail of innocuous activity that the FBI will catalog. I think ever since I was a kid, I was amazed. I wouldn't even have known the words really to figure out exactly, put my finger on exactly what the problem was. But it was, what was surprising to me was the inefficiency, the willingness of J. Edgar Hoover to send these guys out to just follow nobodies around all day, writing down everything they did. I knew a lady who her boyfriend grew weed in California in 1967 or something. Well, she had an FBI file that was hundreds of pages long just based on that. She was no kind of activist of any kind. You know, she just was a hippie who knew a guy. And, like, it's just unbelievable the lengths that they will go to over what any reasonable person would say. Come on, man, that's all that is a slightly left of Democratic Party activist. Why would you hassle them? They're not doing anything, you know?
Yeah, well, and the FBI's guidelines have changed now after the reforms that were put in place. Now, following 9/11, the FBI claims the power to attend any meeting that's open to the public without disclosing that they are FBI officers. The NYPD claims the same power. And so you have that's clearly a recipe for generating all kinds of intelligence on people that should be protected by the First Amendment.
Right. And all the while defining terrorism down, where they even, I think, said that going to a protest is like terrorism light or whatever, right? Instead of
Well, and that's, I think, something that we're going to, in the next, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, I would not at all be surprised if, as the sort of anxieties about cyber attacks and sort of the collusion between national security and protecting banking websites, banking online transactions, as that sort of flattens, I think that any attack, whether even if they're non-violent protests against the status quo, I think that it's not inconceivable that within 5 or 10 years, any sort of resistance to this supremacy of corporate banks will be seen as a form of, it might not be called economic terrorism, but a lot of the same tools that are put, that have been in, put in place to quote unquote fight terrorism will be used against anyone who's pushing back against any too big to fail banks.
Yeah. Well, you know, from time to time we hear the attitude that, well, you know, back when the Republicans were in power, they abused this stuff against left-wing activists, so now it's time for revenge, and vice versa, too, whenever it's the Republicans' turn. Instead of saying, hey, you know, we conservatives need to stand up for the rights of those lefties so that we'll have ours, too, and vice versa, which is, you know, to me, the American way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you see there's a sort of surprising coalition coming together to push back against some of the NSA revelations. You have recently the NRA filed an amicus brief on behalf of an ACLU lawsuit. And so when you have the NRA and the ACLU lining up to attempt to scale back the NSA, I think that that's a pretty remarkable development.
Yeah. In fact, the ACLU came out in favor of some gun rights recently. I forget exactly the issue at stake, but they came out on the side of the NRA on an issue recently, too. So, yeah, that's the kind of realignment we're looking for here for peace and freedom. It's nice to see when it does show up. Well, thanks very much for your time, John. Great work here.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
All right, everybody. That's John Neffel. It's at the Rolling Stone. Is the FBI's domestic spying out of control? Retweet that one, man. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. You can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. You can listen to my KPFK show on 90.7 FM in Los Angeles on Sunday mornings now. They took away my awesome Friday night spot. I think they're going to move me to Mondays here in a month or two. But then again, Sunday morning on KPFK, it's not quite the gardening show hour. It is their traditional kind of Sunday morning news show lineup, like on the TV kind of a thing. So, it's not like nobody's listening. But also then the other good news is that, I know that, the program director there, at KPFK in LA is, trying hard to push the show out to the other Pacific stations. So, I haven't had word back whether that's working or not. But I guess we'll see. But that would be kind of cool if I could get anti-war radio out on, if I was on in Houston and possibly even New York and whatever on the other Pacifica channels. That'd be nice. All right, well, so there's that. All the archives are at scotthorton.org. I'm trying to get back to blogging again. At Stress, which is now new and improved as well over there at scotthorton.org. By the way, join up the chat room. Talk with the guys. Man, I should have got the phone thing set up so I could take a couple of calls from you guys if y'all wanted to call, but I forgot to, so oh well, forget it. I'll just have to talk to you, and you'll just have to pretend to listen. Iran talks substantial. More scheduled. Wait, you know what? I don't even think I finished talking about my Syria news at the beginning. Man, I gotta really start chugging coffee. First of all, I gotta start going to bed earlier and waking up earlier and then chugging more coffee in the morning before this show. I just waste that first half hour of the show every day, don't I? Just waste it. Anyway, I'm wasting this one now. U.S., Russia reach U.N. deal on Syria chemical arms that doesn't include military force. That's your top Syria story. Hooray for Obama backing down. Everybody say it with me. That's what I thought, bitch! All right, there you go. Back down. Let's see. Most of Syria's toxins can be destroyed more easily than officials initially thought. Well, good. Can get rid of them all nice and quick then. Somebody get Scott Ritter out of jail. And then this is the huge one, man. This is the thing. And John Glaze was on the show yesterday talking about this. Anyway, I'm going to talk about it some more now because I don't know if... Did this make TV? I didn't watch the news hour or nothing yesterday. Is anybody making a big deal out of this? That all the so-called moderates joined up with the so-called extremists among the rebels on Tuesday. And so they all signed on to this thing. And this is not, you know, al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq, etc., coming over to McCain's guys, the moderates of the Northern Storm Brigade or something. No, this is everybody joining up with them. As I told you all along, as real journalists have said all along, the al-Nusra Front and the al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State of Iraq, those guys are the leaders in the fight. Because they're the toughest guys and they're the most firm believers. And so they lead. And a bunch of big, fat, Virginia-based, CIA-funded exiles can parade around all day and doesn't mean nothing. They're not doing the fighting. And whatever guns that have been sent this whole time and the money, it all ends up in the hands of the jihadists anyway. I mean, I think that the Saudis and the Qataris, they pick and choose and finance who they want, right? The Qataris favor the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least did, and the Syrians, you know, I mean, the Saudis support the Islamic State guys more or whatever. But no matter what, even if you send all of the guns and all the money straight to the Free Syrian Army, it's the jihadists that end up with them all anyway, because they're the ones using them. It all goes on to the greater rebel black market for weapons anyway. And it's the guys who've pledged their allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri who end up getting them anyway. Which, by the way, Barack Obama, did you ever promise, I guess don't promise to kill Zawahiri, because I wouldn't want you to back down from that. Is there a way that we could make the government, the CIA, Joint Special Operations Command, instead of backing al-Qaeda in Syria, you think we could get them to take like 2 weeks off from that to go to Pakistan and find Zawahiri and kill that guy finally? Please? Thanks. No. Sorry. There I go making the huge mistake that Americans sometimes make, asking their government to ever do anything. Because you know that if you give them permission to go kill Zawahiri in Pakistan, what they'll do is back Zawahiri's legions in Syria in the name of the very same terror war. And anyway, moderates don't fight. Extremists fight. Especially, this is not some, you know, taxpayer-supported government army where it's just a rite of passage for everybody to go and join and be a man, and the star player on every football team goes and joins the army and whatever. It isn't even like that. I mean, we're talking about a volunteer revolution. Moderates don't fight in that. And there are a lot of Westerners involved in the thing, apparently, as well as Chechens and Afghans. We're fighting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan still while we're back in Afghan Mujahideen in Syria. How do you like that? We're back in, that's the next story we're getting to in a second. We're back in the Mujahideen in Syria, the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria, the same one that's attacking our friend Nouri al-Maliki that the Americans fought a 9-year war to install in power in Baghdad. He's screeching about it, too. And anyway, so here they are. Jabhat al-Nusra, the Islamic Ahrar al-Sham movement, the Tawhid Brigade, Islam Brigade, the Sukkur al-Sham Brigades, Islamic Dawn Movement, Islamic Light Movement, the Furkan Brigade, the Ansar Brigade, on and on. Who are these people? Well, Joshua Landis at joshualandis.com, a well-respected Syria expert, when they're not smearing him by trying to attack his wife the one time they invite him on TV. He is a well-respected expert on Syria, and he writes that the alleged signatories make up a major part of the northern rebel force, plus big chunks also of the Homs and Damascus rebel scene, as well as bits of it elsewhere. Some of them are among the biggest armed groups in the country, and I'm thinking now mostly numbers 1 through 5. Altogether, they control at least a few tens of thousand fighters. And if you trust their own estimates, don't, it may be way above 50,000. Most of the major insurgent alliances are included. Liwa al-Tawhid, Liwa al-Islam, and Sukkur al-Sham are both the Western and Gulf-backed Supreme Military Council and the SILF, sort of moderate Islamists. Ahrar al-Sham and Haq are in the SIF, very hardline Islamists. Jabhat al-Nusra, of course, is an al-Qaeda faction. Nur ad-Din al-Zengi are in the Asala wa Tanamiya Alliance. Sorry, I don't speak Arabic. Which is led by quietist Salafis, more or less, as well as the SMC. And so on, most groups may join, but already at this stage, it looks on paper at least like the most powerful insurgent alliance in Syria. So there you go. This means that everything that Kerry and McCain and Hagel and Obama have been saying about backing moderate rebels in Syria this whole time, if there was ever any truth in it, if there's ever any possibility in it, then you'd have to at least concede to the ridiculous warmongering fascist John Bolton that it's just too late to back them now anyway. You blew it. You had your chance to back the Free Syrian Army enough, and you didn't do it. I think that's nonsense. I just explained why with the whole big fat exiles don't fight. They hire Americans to fight for them. They hire Saudi suicide bombers to fight for them. But anyway, it's done. That's it. How could anybody argue that we got to double down on backing the rebels now, when they all just joined together under the umbrella of the Zarqawiites, of the Zawahiriites? That's it. If America absolutely has to intervene in this thing, absolutely has to. Understand my devil's advocate premise of the thing here, which I don't agree with. But if America absolutely has to do something, then it's help Assad win the war quickly. Because this is treason to back these rebels. And if Obama's men, I mean, look, this whole time it has been. But especially, I don't know, why not? I'm drawing my own red line. After today, if Obama is not sending his emissaries to Saudi and Qatar to tell them that's it, you're done, no more money, no more guns, then he's guilty of the highest treason. And you know what I can't figure out? I really honestly got a problem with how come nobody else is saying this, or not nobody else, I don't mean to say that. Lots of people are saying it, I guess. But not nearly enough. It's like people talk about, yeah, gotta back the rebels, the rebels, the rebels, the rebels. And then they'll have a separate conversation about, yeah, the rebels are all a bunch of suicide bomber lunatics. And then they'll go back to their conversation about, yeah, gotta back the rebels, gotta back the rebels, gotta back the rebels. And then they'll have another conversation about, oh yeah, they're a bunch of suicide bombers and prisoner beheaders. Well, can't we have that, both points in one conversation? And doesn't the thing about them being the Zawahiriite, suicide bomber, prisoner beheaders, mean that we cannot, should not, ever, would not, could not, not in a box with a fox or anything else, back these guys? That they're our enemy. If we have any enemies in the world, which is dubious, it's these guys. We don't have a state in the world. This is one of the benefits of knowing a little bit of geography. See, I guess if you don't know what the shape of the world is like at all, if you went to government school and you don't even know, you only know the shape of your town, more or less, or something like that. You don't know what the world is like. You might think there are countries out there where that are enemies of America, but no. There are only so many continents, and they are only full of so many of our allies and or at least friends and or at worst frenemies. I mean, you could say that Russia and China are geopolitical rivals of America or some crap like that, but they're certainly not enemy states of ours. And then that's it. All of Europe are our allies, or at least, you know, outright friends. East and West. All of it. There are no powers in Africa, and virtually every government there, every government our government has bothered to try to take over is run by people at least loyal to us, you know? We have no problems there. There are no powers anywhere in the Middle East. Iran is the most powerful state in the Middle East, and their economy is 3% of ours, less than that. And that's when they're not under sanctions and when we are in a Great Depression. And then that's it. What do you got left? Australia, they're our allies in the British Commonwealth. Japan, they're our allies for the last 70 years. Is it 60-something? I can't do arithmetic on the fly, man. I'm terrible. I really am not good at math. It's not my strong suit at all. But anyway. That's it. You're out of countries. What? Who's your enemy? Kazakhstan or something? Nope. It's not like Atlantis just rose from the sea, from wherever the hell it's supposed to be, I guess, somewhere in the Mediterranean, right? And then they're our enemy now. That's it. No enemies. You're out of continents where you could have enemies. The only enemies we got? The Bin Ladenite suicide bomber types. And we're backing them. Our government is backing them in Syria. And I can't figure out, again, it's sort of like the thing about John McCain. John McCain went and met with the Northern Storm Brigade, a deal that was set up for him by Elizabeth Obagi and the Syrian, what you call it, State Department front group. And he wanted to spend the night. According to her, which she's a liar, so maybe that's not true, but it seemed to be true at the time. And the security guys had to, you know, overrule that. But then, all it takes is one Google search, Northern Storm Brigade. You don't need anything more than that. Just Google search, Northern Storm Brigade. There it is. Time Magazine interviews them. And there's the Northern Storm Brigade, at least one of them saying, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War where I fought the Americans. Presumably, and someone challenged me about this on the Twitter, I guess I should work in, presumably as part of Zarqawi's group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or the Islamic State of Iraq, as it's called, whatever they called it. That was the umbrella group that certainly the super majority of foreigners who fought in the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq against the Americans and the Shiite government the Americans were installing there were members of that group. Maybe not every single one of them. But anyway, certainly by John McCain's standards, anyone who was in the Sunni-based insurgency at all was a terrorist. All of them. We're in league with Zarqawi. For anyone but him to back any of them would be outright treason. At least Petraeus had the whole scam where, you know, well, we're bribing the concerned local citizens. the Sons of Iraq, and they're all of the non-Al-Qaeda Sunni-based insurgents, and we're going to pay them to fight Al-Qaeda for us, and we're going to pay them enough to leave us alone while they do it. So I explained on the show yesterday, they'd already lost Baghdad. They needed to stop and regroup anyway. That's what Patrick Cockburn says, and Patrick Cockburn is smart. And so that wasn't... You know, it was to a degree paying former Al-Qaeda and Iraq soldiers or Iraqis who had been, you know, members of that group on the lower level or whatever. But really it was paying the leaders of the Iraqi Sunni community to take on the foreign Zarqawiite suicide bomber types and limit their ability to, you know, move and act, I guess. And it worked for a while. But anyway, these are the guys who are right back in action now. And there's John McCain's buddies, the Northern Storm Brigade. At least one of them going, yeah, I'm a member. I'm a veteran of the Iraq War. What? Just like in Libya, where John McCain, of course, was for Gaddafi before he was against him, before he was for him again, before he was against him again. Really? John McCain's been in Congress that long. I don't know if he was ever for him in the first place. Maybe not. Certainly in the 80s, he was against him. Then for him, after Bush made peace in 03 and tried to sell him weapons and everything, and then against him. And those guys were veterans of the Iraq War, too. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, they would have been colleagues of Zarqawi, too. And so I don't get it why none dare call it treason. You know? Come on. What are we talking about here? America's on the side of the Mujahideen. You know what? It's not like it's a COINTELPRO inside job or anything. It's just annoying to me that really the right-wingers wore this out with all their false accusations against Obama for being a Muslim and being from Kenya and all that stupid crap. Because the truth is, like I was saying before, he does this because he's a white American conservative imperialist. But he's still guilty of treason. But they wore that out like Pee Wee Herman's name, you know what I mean? Oh, here's some commercials. Nope, too late for commercials. Here's the intro music back from the commercials again. Hey, y'all, Scott here. The jobless rate in America keeps climbing. Food stamps and other social welfare spending continue to increase at an alarming rate. And the only thing that's kept this whole so-called recovery going at all is the Federal Reserve's inflationary printing press. Seems like 2008 might have just been a rehearsal for the financial crisis still to come. So now let me talk to you about this great video by Dr. Martin Weiss from MoneyAndMarkets.com. The video spells out how this disaster will affect you and create enormous financial opportunities if you know how to recognize a true diamond in the rough. Weiss shows when stocks have crashed and even gives the names of the biggest banks that are most likely to fail. Before you invest $1, take the time to watch this new video. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Learn from the experts how to evaluate these opportunities and start making better informed decisions that will lead to a better return on your investments. That's Dr. Martin Weiss at crisis16.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up here in just a few minutes, Joe Loria, you and Joe. He's the Wall Street Journal's man at the United Nations building. And a good reporter, and by my watch, he should be done talking to Rouhani, questioning Rouhani now. He's attending a press conference of the Iranian president right now. I'm sorry to be so stupid and naive, silly and young, boyish even. But man, I've got hope that Obama will make a deal with Iran on their nuclear program. It's such a stupid red herring. I know, and you know, we all know they're not making nukes, and they don't even want to make nukes. They want the breakout capability to maybe one day make nukes, but they don't want to make nukes. They're just like Japan. They're just sitting there holding on to the cards. That's all. They're not playing them. We all know that. The whole thing is a big stupid red herring, but it's the perfect red herring. You know why? Because nuclear means scary as hell. That's why George Bush, Colin Powell, and Condoleezza Rice all went on TV and said we can't let the smoking gun, you know, any evidence at all, be a mushroom cloud over an American city when it came to people asking critical questions about, are you guys ever going to provide any evidence that Saddam is spinning centrifuges over there? Come on, man. What, he's got a secret nuclear weapons program? Where's he hiding it? Hey, look, we can't wait for your town to blow up. Jeez, I guess you're right. We can't take the risk. Go ahead. So it makes the perfect, you know, bludgeon. Because the American people, 99% of us, don't know the first thing about a non-proliferation treaty or nuclear technology either. So that means we defer to the experts. And if the experts say, be afraid, because there's a nuclear something that could nuke you in your jammies in the middle of the night, and then you'll be dead, and then what are you going to do? Then we defer to that. Those experts apparently know what they're talking about. I can barely do algebra 2, and they're telling me that somebody's going to split uranium atoms over my head. Please don't. Please stop them. So, here the Iranians have been saying this all along. As I'm sure if you've been listening to the show over the last week, you might have picked up on that. All along, the Iranians have been saying, yeah, let's negotiate. Let's negotiate. Well, here they're doing it real well. Here they're saying the Holocaust was terrible. And here, let's release some political prisoners. And hey, I really like your tie. And happy Rosh Hashanah. And let's make a nuclear deal, please. Is that how you pronounce it? I don't know how to pronounce people's religious holidays, you know. I think that's how it is. Anyway, let's make a nuclear deal. We would like to make a serious deal. We want to make it. We'd like to make it soon. Would you like to make a nuclear deal with us? Now listen, I'm providing a rough translation from the original Farsi, but it was pretty much that. That's what we've heard from their president Rouhani this whole time. And so, hey, let's take him up on it. That's my thing. And it seems like the Israelis are the only lobby in America. Well, I don't know. I guess the weapons and, you know, the Arabs, the Saudis, and maybe some of the other Arab kingdoms. And then, of course, the arms manufacturers, Lockheed and Raytheon and General Dynamics and some of those others, I guess probably are in on it too. But I don't know. This is part of the problem of having such a socialized economy. There are very few centers of wealth and power in America that are just not wholly dependent on the central state and its good graces, you know? It's impossible to be independent from them at this point and have any, you know, real amount of wealth and influence. So, you know, you could really have the entire nation, except for the executive vice presidents of Lockheed and Raytheon and Israel, pushing for this war, and they could still win and the rest of us lose, you know, or pushing at least to stop the policy of making peace and, you know, really short-circuiting the path to war. In fact, it should be easy for them to stop it, right? I have an article here somewhere. Where the hell is it now? Here it is. It's in the Israel, was it the Israel Times? Timesofisrael.com. U.S. lawmakers unenthused by drive for rapprochement with Iran. I think it was, I can't remember now if it was Glazer or Gharib or Walt or who it was came on the show this week and said, the president can only do a waiver for lifting of sanctions on a small minority of them. This is where Congress exercises their most foreign policy authority, is on sanctions. And a lot of these sanctions cannot be repealed or, you know, waived, suspended by the president alone. And so, this is how a foreign state does an end run around the president and his foreign policy of trying to make, assuming he even really wants to take the Iranians up on this offer and really make a deal. This is how the Israelis can make sure that he can't. Is just use the Congress against him. Now, in fact, they quote here McCain, Graham, and Ayotte. She's the new Lieberman there. I don't know how you say her name. Ayotte, whatever. She's a real jerk, this senator lady. Real bad on foreign policy. And they say in a joint statement here, we support the willingness of the Obama administration to test the credibility of the Iranian regime's diplomatic overtures. However, we are deeply skeptical about the real motivations behind their charm offensive. Yeah, hey, that's what Benjamin Netanyahu says to call it. So you have your marching orders. We need to approach the current diplomatic initiative with eyes wide open. And we must not allow Iran to use negotiations as a tool of delay and deception. A real negotiation does not mean the diplomats talk while the Iranians enrich. So, in other words, they're willing to draw the line and insist on the Iranians ceasing all enrichment. Which, you know, I was actually surprised to hear Ali Gharib on the show kind of to the right of Obama on this. Obama has officially said they have to stop enriching, but he's also offered deals and spoken in terms before that would seem to indicate some wiggle room and that perhaps he would, in fact, recognize Iran's right, maybe not recognize the right under the treaty de jure, but de facto anyway, that, okay, go ahead and enrich, but just keep it at 3.6% and don't make it 20 because Benjamin Netanyahu squeals like a pig at 20 and we prefer him squealing like a guinea pig. It's easier on our ears. If you just keep it at 3.6%, whatever. But anyway, so I guess we'll see how that goes. I happen to think, and maybe this is just me, but I happen to think that Israel is wearing out its welcome. And that when it comes down to it, even if we don't like Obama, the majority of Americans would support our own president's attempt to make peace, again, assuming he's really willing to try. We would support Obama's attempt to make peace with Iran, certainly over any foreign government's attempt to thwart that negotiation. And we might even resent their interference. Like, hey, Benjamin Netanyahu, maybe you need to just pipe down. In fact, that was a point of view of Ali Gharib's that I certainly agreed with. Yeah, the Israelis are a sideshow here. They don't really matter. They're like, they're not playing the game. They're just some screaming nut in the stands. I like that. Oh, yeah, Benjamin Netanyahu's barking again, huh? Tell him I said shut up. I won't even bother telling him myself, because really, who cares? Tell him I said shut up or not, because I don't really care. How about that? Man, I blew another break. Well, I got to talking about how much I hate Israel now. I swear to God, I'm going to get Patrick Coburn on the show for you guys at some point soon, I guess next week. He's written a bunch of good stuff, horrifying stuff about Libya and what's going on there. It's like a veritable news blackout on Libya, isn't it? I'm going to try to do a little something about that. See if I can get the great Patrick Coburn on the air about it. Alright, now I'm just looking for a song to play you that I really need to put a new list of songs together here. I'll try to get something, pick something a little easier on your ears than the usual. I know how whiny and complaining you people can be about good music. I could play Wesley Willis. And some of you would certainly change the channel. Here you go. Everybody loves this one. Give me just one sec, okay? And I'll see if I can get us Joe Lurie on the line here. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on No Agenda Radio and scotthorton.org/listen. You can find all my interview archives at scotthorton.org. 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 Almost 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. Scotthorton.org. And also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. Okay, so. Sorry, I blew that break. I got to talking about the Iran thing and blowing Joe's interview before it even starts. But let me say real quick here, since I blew that break, Liberty Classroom. Check out the Liberty Classroom. Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And also, I'll give a speech. Just pay me not very much money at all, and I'll give you a great old speech about whatever you want. You know, foreign policy stuff mostly, police state. And then TheBumperSticker.com, and buy the book White Peace, because it's got a bunch of great libertarians writing a bunch of great anti-war stuff in it, and some good lefties, too. That's Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman. Just go to ScottHorton.org and look on the right side of the page there. Okay, so now introducing our friend Joe Loria. He is the Wall Street Journal's man at the United Nations. Welcome back to the show. Joe, how the hell are you?
I am fine, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us. And now, am I correct? You just finished attending a press conference hosted by the president of Iran.
That's correct. I'm sitting outside the room right now. People are leaving the press conference. So a little bit of noise around us, but he didn't make much noise. He got a little testy with Margaret Warner of PBS, who basically accused him of deceiving the world during when he was head of the nuclear negotiations back in 2003. She accused him of saying behind the back of the negotiators completing the Isfahan nuclear facility, and he vehemently denied that, said that it had all been declared before one brick was built in this facility. The IAEA had been informed, and he got really angry and said that they would not do this again. He promised that this time, you know, there's not going to be any deception on the part of Iran. He said that the people and the three branches of power in Iran are behind him solidly in terms of these new nuclear negotiations. He didn't say what those three were, except one of them was the people of Iran who just elected him. He thanked them numerous times. He seemed to be still in campaign mode a lot at times, too, in the promises of improving the economy of Iran. But the other two have to be the Revolutionary Guard and the Supreme Lead, Ayatollah Khamenei, obviously. So he didn't say that by name. But he is saying he has the Revolutionary Guards and the Supreme Leader behind him to negotiate this nuclear deal with the Western powers that got kicked off yesterday when John Kerry met with the Foreign Minister of Iran and the Foreign Ministers of Germany, the UK, France, China, and Russia, the P5 plus one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of excitement in the air at the UN in this General Assembly because there's actually diplomacy on Iran and on Syria. Tonight, Security Council most likely will pass a resolution to make legal and to make legally binding the U.S.-Russian deal on destroying chemical weapons in Syria. So there's lots to talk about, but those are the two big issues at this GA, Iran and Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, obviously. Okay, so first of all, now in this press conference, did he draw any lines or has he previously drawn any lines saying that, you know, whether he's actually open to negotiating the Natanz facility and the enrichment up to 3.6%? Are they still sticking by, listen, we're not going to give it all up, but we might cease enriching at 20% and that kind of thing?
He did not go into any detail like that, though he was pressed a couple of times. He's saying that those proposals that they're going to make in Geneva in 3 weeks when this starts in earnest are still being prepared by Iran. But he's sticking with every appearance he's made, and he's been all over the place on every media, possibly. This is his last big media appearance. He's sticking by the fact that Iran has the right to enrich uranium, according to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which they're a member, with IAEA supervision. So they're not going to give up enrichment. They're going to prove to the world that they're not making a bomb, that they don't believe in the bomb, that it's against Islam, etc. So this is the task he set ahead of himself to prove, with the IAEA and with the powers, that the Iranian government is not seeking a bomb, and they're going to prove it this time, that they're going to continue to enrich. As far as the levels of enrichment, et cetera, you just asked, there's nothing being said about that at this point. But that will come out, you know, in Geneva in about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in fact, I was speaking with Ali Gharib the other day, and he was saying, I guess I was saying, I thought that, well, what they really want was, you know, a breakout capability so that, sort of a pseudo-mad deterrent, not really a full-fledged mad deterrent. And he said that he thought that they really created the nuclear program just as a bargaining chip to negotiate away at some point if they had to anyway, and that, you know, maybe the whole thing would be up for negotiation. I'm not saying that I care, but obviously that's the Israeli position and therefore Congress's position, and I just wonder whether, you know, maybe they would be willing to even go that far if they got a good enough security guarantee and the lifting of the sanctions, et cetera.
You mean go as far as what? Stop enrichment altogether?
Yeah, shut down Natanz and just say, you know what, we'll just...
I don't know that. I mean, look, they want the sanctions over. The sanctions are hurting them. There's no question about it. On the...
Back in 03, they were willing to negotiate at all, right?
Back in 03, that was 10 years ago. The sanctions did not have anywhere near the effect that they've had in those 10 years. And right now, he was asked about the economy, and he said when he looked at the books becoming president, it was worse than he thought, even though he was the head of an economic research center before this, before becoming president. So he had a finger on the economy. It's much worse than he thought. They expect optimism they can overcome it, but they cannot overcome it without the sanctions being lifted. And the sanctions won't be lifted until there's real progress in these talks. And whether they don't necessarily have to give up enrichment at the end of the day. I mean, that is the Security Council demand now, to suspend enrichment. But I think if they really tell them the truth, that they don't want the bomb and they only want nuclear power, something could be worked out. They want those sanctions lifted, and I think this time there might be for real. But, you know, time will tell.
Well, you know,
the tone
it seems
has certainly changed, yeah.
Other than the war party, it seems like all of the honest analysis is that the Iranians really mean it, and the question is whether there's the will on the American side to see this thing through. I mean, the outlines of the deal are pretty obvious to all.
My view is there is absolutely the will on the part of the Obama administration, but they're being ferociously lobbied by the two most powerful lobbying groups inside the United States, which are the Saudis and the Israelis. Those countries want a deal at all. They're terrified of a deal. They do not want a lessening of tensions on the nuclear issue. They want to remove the government of Iran, and they want to limit and roll back Iran's influence across the region. The Saudis in particular, with Bahrain, in Lebanon, and most importantly in Syria. And I think that the Saudis and the Iranians hold the key to the end of the conflict in Syria. They are the two major outside players who control extremist groups, both of them, who are doing most of the really important fighting inside Syria, not the Russians and the Americans, as some people are saying that, because they have this chemical deal that could lead to Geneva. Without the Saudis and the Iranians coming together on Syria, on Bahrain, on Lebanon, Afghanistan, there's no real solutions to these issues. And I don't think that this is going to happen necessarily, because, and as far as the American position, I do think Obama has really ticked off the Saudis and the Israelis. First, on the chemical weapons deal, both of them wanted desperately the U.S. intervene in this war, because they need American power, firepower. Nobody else could do it. So they have to try to control and maybe even trick Obama into getting involved in that civil war. And that has failed because this chemical weapons deal, that the American intervention in Syria is off the table. And now we've got a resolution passing tonight, probably at the Security Council, in which Syria is giving up their chemical weapons over the next 6 months to a year, and that is really ticking off the Israelis and the Saudis. And then you have the Iranian issue. They don't want a deal. They don't want a lessening of tensions. They don't want Iran to give up their nuclear program and take off the table military action by the U.S. to destroy the Iranian government, to roll back Iranian influence across the region. So I think as far as American sincerity goes, the way you read it, they're being very cautious. But, you know, the United – President Obama is the president of the United States, and he has his own American interests to look after, look for, and not necessarily be pushed by the Saudis and the Israelis on this. And I think that's where the pressure is. Of course, as we know, Congress is much more pliable to the Israeli and the Saudi influence than Obama seems to be. Congress seems to be bought, completely sold on this issue. So Obama's got Congress. He's got the neocons who are, of course, Netanyahu's corner here in the U.S., and he's got the Israelis and the Saudis breathing down his neck not to go ahead with any kind of settlement in Iran on their nuclear program, and even on this chemical weapons deal. I think they're hoping that it fails so that they can get American military intervention back on the table in both places.
Yeah. Well, now, so from the talks that they've had so far, I guess yesterday they talked for, what, an hour or two or something, Kerry and the foreign minister of Iran did?
Well, there was 1 hour with all the foreign ministers of the five countries.
It was the whole P5 plus one, right.
But also, Kerry had a side meeting, he told us, as he came out of the briefing, with Javad Zarif, who is the new foreign minister of Iran, the former U.N. ambassador here, who most of the press corps here knows quite well. So they had a side meeting, too. I thought that was just sort of, I don't know what the substance of that was. That hasn't been revealed, but it seemed like just a shaking hands. And this handshake stuff's been such BS, I have to say, because the press has made so much of this that Ronnie didn't shake Obama's hand, didn't show up with that thing. You know, that's just all atmospheric, so this has some importance. But the real issue is going forward in Geneva, whether there's going to be a real progress on this deal or not, whether people shake hands or not. But there's certainly a new opening here. Last night I called it a rapprochement, and the British ambassador corrected me. He might be right in that we have not necessarily have a rapprochement between Iran and the U.S., but there's a new opening that could lead to an absolute lessening of tensions between Iran and the U.S. It's a possible resolution of the Iranian nuclear issue, and also Syria. It could have a big impact on Syria. And again, I cannot overestimate, I think, how I've seen the Saudi and what I hear. Saudi and Israelis really, and the Israelis openly, you know, criticizing both of these deals. They just don't want this to happen. So Obama has to stand firm against them, pursue what's in the interest of the United States, not in the interest of Saudi Arabia, not in the interest of Israel.
Yeah, well, good
and
luck
the region,
to us.
People of the region. Yeah, good luck. And the people of the region, by the way. I don't think, who wants a war with Iran? I mean, how many people would be killed by that? I don't know, what kind of a devastating conflict that could be for the Gulf. For the entire region. So I think that Obama's in a way, even not directly, looking out for the people of the region by at least pursuing this diplomatic path. And don't forget, the American intelligence community does not say that they're going to come up with a bomb tomorrow or even in 6 months or a year, no matter how many times Netanyahu draws that red line, which keeps moving.
Right.
I think they were supposed to already have the bomb by now, right, according to the speech last year at the U.N.? So it's time to pursue this, even if it fails. There's no reason not to pursue this diplomatic path with the Iranians, and they've tested out. And there's no reason not to try to get rid of serious chemical weapons, because that was supposed to be the purpose of the military intervention by the U.S. in Syria, which was to degrade their ability to use chemical weapons. Well, isn't it much better to get rid of the entire program altogether? Which, of course, there's no guarantee this is going to happen. But I asked Samantha Power last night at a press conference. I told her that at that same podium a few weeks ago, she said that the Security Council doesn't work because U.S. couldn't get Russian vote to authorize U.S. military strike against Syria. I said, now here you're standing here tonight with a deal that can get rid of those chemical weapons better than a military strike would have done. So how do you feel about the Security Council now? Is it working tonight now?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she had a backtrack on that. And this is a typical American so-called exceptionalism, which is really arrogance, for the U.S. to go to the United Nations and to say, if we get our way, it's great. If we don't, the U.N. doesn't work. I mean, and this is exactly what she was saying. And now it's working for them. But she had to backtrack on that. This is a much better deal if it works. Now, this resolution that's going to pass tonight, I should point out, not only provides for a second resolution that could impose sanctions or even military action against either party that disrupts this. The reporting you're going to see is all about the Syrian government being in noncompliance with this chemical deal, not being forthcoming about where all the chemicals are, blocking inspectors. But the actual language of the resolution, which was negotiated with Russia, and they had to get Russia's agreement in order to pass it, also includes other parties and all parties within Syria, which means the opposition. That if the opposition uses chemical weapons or transfers them, they could also be punished. So Russia can go to the Security Council and ask for a resolution under Chapter 7 to punish rebels if they have any evidence that they've used or moved chemical weapons. And, of course, the West can come forward if the Syrian government has done that. And there's this belief that actually that Russia would definitely veto this resolution if it came, if the West tried to punish Syria for noncompliance with the chemical deal. But that's not necessarily true, because Putin has a lot on the line, and this Russian president, Vladimir Putin, does. He's put his reputation here that the Syrian government will give up their chemicals. So he's going to put a lot of pressure on the Syrians to do this. And right now, this thing's looking like it could actually happen. If anybody disrupts this destruction, first collection and then destruction of Syria's chemical weapons under international supervision, it could be the rebels. They don't want this deal. They're on the same page with the Iranians, with the Saudis and the Israelis. The opposition in Syria does not want this chemical deal to go forward. They want American intervention. So if they could disrupt it, that could put American intervention back on the table. And they probably want to get their hands on some of this chemical stuff, too, if Assad was overthrown. So they don't want the chemicals to leave. Even though they were supposedly the big victims of this August 21 attack, they are the ones who don't want the chemical weapons deal on the people inside Syria are the rebels. You have to watch out for the rebels trying to disrupt this. So this resolution that's going to pass tonight will get the ball rolling on that. And, yes, there's no immediate provision for enforcement, but if there's a violation by either side, anybody on the Security Council can come forward and ask for enforcement mechanism, which would probably be sanctions against them or military action.
Right. Now, as far as rapprochement, it seems like, you know, the nuclear deal to me is just a red herring. As long as the IAEA continues to verify the non-diversion nuclear material this whole time, the whole thing is just blowing smoke to me. But it seems like it is the big sticking point, even more than the war in Syria is, and that, you know, maybe if they could make a nuclear deal, then that could really be a big step toward just normalizing relations. Do you think anybody in D.C. or in New York, for that matter, can actually visualize a whole new Middle East where we get along just fine with the Iranians? Hell, we just fought a war for them in Iraq, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Some people may be dreaming that. I don't know. Probably too early to visualize that, but that certainly could be the end of this road.
I mean, that's what I want, but does anybody with power want that at all?
Yeah. Look, I think that the way the Obama administration, the way Kerry and Obama are behaving right now, after all of that saber rattling, especially by Kerry, who was acting like president, if you remember, he was making all the tough speeches that Bush made before the Iraq invasion. He was pounding his chest. It gave you the impression that Obama was kind of reluctant to this. Kerry was allowed to play president for a while. And now, all of a sudden, they seem sincere about this chemical weapons deal and sincere about pursuing a nuclear deal with Iran. Now, right. Whether you say that this is all academic or not, certainly the American side does not believe the Iranians, nor do the British and the French and the Germans. They really need to see what's going on, and the IAEA really has to go in there, and the Iranians have to come completely clean and leave no doubt that they're not pursuing a weapon, that they can't pursue a weapon, that there are safeguards put in, that they can only pursue enrichment for peaceful purposes, for medical research, for electricity. And so that's the hurdle that has to be passed in these talks with the Iranians. And while others may accept that Iran is telling the truth now, the principal Western powers don't. And that's what has to be proven. And there's a real chance that could happen. And there's a real chance that serious chemical weapons can be all destroyed. And this is an extraordinary turn of events this week here at the UN General Assembly, which is normally just a talk fest and nothing really concrete comes out of it. We have two major diplomatic developments here in New York, and it could change in the short term and in the long term the face of the Middle East, as you say. But I do think that the Saudis and the Iranians have to come together, because Saudi Arabia and Israel do not want this diplomacy to succeed, and they both are very powerful in the region and could play spoiler. So these are the ones to watch out for how they respond. And Netanyahu is going to speak next week, and you know he's already been denouncing Rouhani. He's already denouncing these deals. They're against it. And people listen, unfortunately, in Congress and in the American media. We have to listen to what he's saying, but we should disagree with him on this at least, because he's trying to put a he's trying to put a wrench here in the machinery of diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And we really, I think Obama's got to stand up to him. That's the real question. Will he stand up to the Saudis and the Iranians on Syria? Sorry, the Saudis and the Israelis, excuse me, it's very noisy on here. Saudis and the Israelis on Syria and Iran.
Well, now on Netanyahu, maybe this is just wishful thinking, but it seemed to me with that cartoon bomb last time that he really just jumped the shark and nobody takes him seriously. And then especially after Syria pushing so hard and having AIPAC push so hard to try to get us to attack Syria and then failed at making that happen. At this point, isn't he sort of just a self-parody? I almost think it's better if he goes up there and gives a real right-wing hawkish speech so that then the whole place will just all roll their eyes at him, including the Americans, and just say, you know, thanks, Doug Feith, but, you know, we'll talk to you later on.
Well, you see it that way. I might see it that way. And a lot of people, maybe the majority, see it that way. But does everybody in Congress see it that way? Do all the editorial writers in the U.S. see it that way? Do the neocon think tanks that are still influential see it that way? But as you say, they failed on Syria. They were in top gear, those think tanks and AIPAC. And they failed there. And they're failing on Iran so far. And they may look like a parody of themselves. But they're not going to give up, and we'll see what kind of leverage they really have. It's quite an interesting moment. It's being put to the test just how powerful these forces are that under the Bush administration had free rein because they're willing partners in the administration. But here, the we can criticize Obama on a lot of issues, but on here it looks like there's a real distinction with the Bush administration in terms of standing up to those two forces to try to push through diplomacy and being attacked as weak. And don't forget, Gulf Arabs, too, are saying that he was weak on Syria and that Rouhani's trying to take advantage of him now because of that. So there's also the Saudis and the other Gulf countries. I don't want to give them a pass, like the UAE and the Qataris and these people.
Right.
But these are the really strong lines being drawn right now. And again, we'll see how it turns out. Will Obama buckle to this? The whole thing is, if it fails, then they're gonna scream. The Netanyahu, the neocons, their choir in Congress will scream that. We told you so. That this guy is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Can't trust him. And we told you so all along. But you know what? Even if that happens, even if it fails, there's always time to go to war, unfortunately. I just think that the fact that the Israelis and the Saudis are so upset about this means that the real chance it could work. Because if they didn't think there was any chance of this deal happening, probably wouldn't say very much. They just let it collapse and then push their war agenda. But I think they're really terrified. Yeah. Terrified that there could be a chemical weapon deal that works in Syria and a nuclear deal that works in Iran.
Now, on the chemical weapons deal in Syria, are you reading it the same way as me that from the Russians' point of view that they have not only Putin's prestige that he said he's going to make this happen, but also the fact that if they can really get rid of the chemical weapons out of there quickly, then that takes away even the possibility of that red line being crossed anymore, which really takes all the wind out of the sail of the Assad must go crowd in Washington, D.C. And then a minor point for you to address, too, is, and then isn't it the case, or to what degree do you think it's the case that with Russian resources available, they could really get rid of all those chemical weapons very efficiently and quickly and avoid the possibility of the rebels, screwing it all up before they can get it done?
Well, on the first question, you're absolutely right. If these things are eliminated, there's no red line, because the red line was only about chemical weapons. It was only about degrading that. It was never about regime change, at least not openly. And don't forget, Obama said at the UN the other day that he doesn't want regime change in Iran either. These are things that really upset the Saudis and the Israelis. So, yes, the red line was about chemicals. If they're removed, there's no reason anymore for the U.S. to even threaten military action and intervention in Syria. Now, on your repeat the second question again.
Do you think that Putin will be able to just send his version of the C-130s and get rid of that stuff on the double?
Yeah. If you see, the Washington Post has a really interesting story today where they talk to a lot of chemical experts, and it appears that the vast majority of this 1,000 tons of chemical weapons are precursor chemicals, unmixed, and that they could be neutralized much more easily than the sarin that's already been mixed, ready to use, or already in warheads. So that they think that this could be a much quicker process if it's true that the vast majority of what they have are the chemicals that are corrosive, they say, but not as dangerous, of course, as if sarin has already been mixed, and also, and the other, and VX nerve gas, too, and that the only thing they think is really weaponized and ready to go is the mustard gas. That's already, they think, the majority of that. But the other thing is also the equipment that they use to mix it. If that could be destroyed or removed from the country, that they wouldn't be able to. So you already very quickly could neutralize Syria's ability to use chemical weapons, if not take all those precursor chemicals and the actual chemical weapons out of the country or destroy them within the country. And yes, Russia has offered troops, by the way, to protect the inspectors. But the primary responsibility, the resolution says, is with the Syrian government, the Syrian army to protect these inspectors. And I think they have to be protected from rebel attacks who are going to try to disrupt this process because they want American intervention.
All right, that's it. We're out of time. Thanks very much, Joe. I sure appreciate it.
Yes, again, I apologize again for all the noise going around and the distractions, but I appreciate being on your show again.
Yeah, no problem. I sure appreciate you doing it. All right, everybody, that's Joe Loria. He's the Wall Street Journal's man at the United Nations. Talking Syria and Iran deals. KPFK, Sunday morning. Otherwise, see you Monday.